or as brave and young as you.
Still smiling, he turned to enter the Aeolian.
Good night, then.
Good night.
Diok wished that he were more like me. It was as great a compliment as any I had ever been given. But even better than that was the fact that my days of fruitlessly searching for dinner were at an end. Tomorrow, at noon, in the Aeolian. Lunch and talking and walking, as she had phrased it. The thought filled me with a giddy excitement. How young I was. How foolish. How wise. Chapter 66. Volatile. I woke early the next morning, nervous at the thought of lunch with Denner. Knowing it would be useless to attempt to get back to sleep, I headed to the fishery. Last night's extravagant spending had left me with exactly 3 pennies in my pocket, and I was eager to take advantage of my newly earned position. Usually I worked nights in the fishery. It was a different place in the mornings. There were only 15 or 20 people there pursuing their individual projects. In the evenings there were usually twice that many. Kilvin was in his office, as always, but the atmosphere was more relaxed, busy but not bustling. I even saw Fela off in the corner of the shop, chipping carefully away at a piece of obsidian the size of a large loaf of bread. Small wonder I'd never seen her here before if she made a habit of being in the shop this early. Despite Manet's warning, I decided to make a batch of blue emitters for my first project. Tricky work, as it required the use of bone tar, but they would sell fairly quickly, and the whole process would only take me 4 or 5 hours of careful work. Not only could I be done in time to meet with Denner at the Aeolian for lunch, but I might be able to get a small advance from Kilvin so I could have a bit of money in my purse when I went to meet her. I gathered the necessary tools and set up in one of the fume hoods along the eastern wall. I chose a place near a drench, one of the 500-gallon tanks of twice-tough glass that were spaced throughout the workshop. If you spilled something dangerous on yourself while working in the hoods, you could simply pull the drench's handle and rinse yourself clean in a stream of cool water. Of course, I would never need the drench so long as I was careful, but it was nice having it close, just in case. After setting up the fume hood, I made my way to the table where the bone tar was kept. Despite the fact that I knew it was no more dangerous than a stone saw or the sintering wheel, I found the burnished metal container unnerving. And today, something was different. I caught the attention of one of the more experienced artificers as he walked past. Jaxim had the haggard look common to most artificers in the middle of large projects, as if he were putting off sleep until it was entirely finished. "Should there be this much frost?" I asked him, pointing out the tar canister. Its edges were covered in fine white tufts of frost, like tiny shrubs. The air around the metal actually shimmered with cold. Jaxim peered at it, then shrugged.
"Better too cold than not cold enough," he said with a humorless chuckle. "Kaboom!"
I couldn't help but agree, and guessed that it might have something to do with the workshop being cooler this early in the morning. None of the kilns had been fired up yet, and most of the forge fires were still banked and sullen. Moving carefully, I ran through the decanting procedure in my head, making sure I hadn't forgotten anything. It was so cold that my breath hung white in the air. The sweat on my hands froze my fingers to the canister's fastenings the same way a curious child's tongue sticks to a pump handle in the dead of winter. I decanted about 1 ounce of the thick, oily liquid into the pressure vial and quickly applied the cap. Then I made my way back to the fume hood and started preparing my materials. After a few tense minutes, I began the long, meticulous process of preparing and doping a set of blue emitters. My concentration was broken 2 hours later by a voice behind me. It wasn't particularly loud, but it held a serious tone you never ignore in the fishery. It said,
"Oh my God!"
Because of my current work, the first thing I looked at was the bone tar canister. I felt a flash of cold sweat roll over me when I saw black liquid leaking from one corner and running down the work table's leg to pool on the floor, The thick timber of the table's leg was almost entirely eaten away, and I heard a light popping and crackling as the liquid pooling on the floor began to boil. All I could think of was Kilvin's statement during the demonstration. In addition to being highly corrosive, the gas burns when it comes in contact with air. Even as I turned to look, the leg gave way and the work table began to tip. The burnished metal canister tumbled down. When it struck the stone floor, the metal was so cold it didn't simply crack or dent, it shattered like glass. Gallons of the dark fluid burst out in a great splay across the workshop floor. The room filled with sharp crackling and popping sounds as the bone tar spread across the warm stone floor and started to boil. Long ago, the clever person who designed the fishery placed about 2 dozen drains in the workshop to help with cleaning and managing spills. What's more, the workshop stone floor rose and fell in a gentle pattern of peaks and troughs to guide the spills toward those drains. That meant as soon as the container shattered, the wide spill of oily liquid began to run off in 2 different directions, heading for 2 different drains. At the same time, it continued to boil, forming thick, low clouds, dark as tar, caustic and ready to burst into flame. Trapped between these 2 spreading arms of dark fog was Fela, who had been working by herself at an out-of-the-way table in the corner of the shop. She stood, her mouth half open in shock. She was dressed practically for work in the shop, light trousers and a gauzy linen shirt cuffed at the elbow. Her long dark hair was pulled back into a tail, but still hung down to nearly the small of her back. She would burn like a torch. The room began to fill with frantic noise as people realized what was happening. They shouted orders or simply yelled in panic. They dropped tools and knocked over half-finished projects as they scrambled around. Fela hadn't screamed or called for help, which meant no one but me had noticed the danger she was in. If Kilvin's demonstration was any indication, I guessed the whole shop could be a sea of flame and caustic fog in less than a minute. There wasn't any time. I glanced at the scattered projects on the nearby work table, looking for anything that could be of some help, but there was nothing. A jumble of basalt blocks, spools of copper wire, a half-inscribed hemisphere of glass that was probably destined to become one of Kilvin's lamps. And as easy as that, I knew what I had to do. I grabbed the glass hemisphere and dashed it against one of the basalt blocks. It shattered, and I was left with a thin, curved shard of broken glass about the size of my palm. With my other hand, I grabbed my cloak from the table and strode past the fume hood. I pressed my thumb against the edge of the piece of glass and felt an unpleasant tugging sensation, followed by a sharp pain. Knowing I'd drawn blood, I speared my thumb across the glass and spoke a binding. As I came to stand in front of the drench, I dropped the glass to the floor, concentrated, and stepped down hard, crushing it with my heel. Cold, unlike anything I'd ever felt, stabbed into me. Not the simple cold you feel in your skin and limbs on a winter day. It hit my body like a clap of thunder. I felt it in my tongue and lungs and liver. But I got what I wanted. The twice-tough glass of the drench spider-webbed into 1,000 fractures, and I closed my eyes just as it burst. 500 gallons of water struck me like a great fist, knocking me back a step and soaking me through to the skin. Then I was off, running between the tables. Quick as I wasn't quick enough. There was a blinding crimson flare from the corner of the workshop as the fog began to catch fire, sending up strangely angular tongues of violent red flame. The fire would heat the rest of the tar, causing it to boil more quickly. This would make more fog, more fire, and more heat. As I ran, the fire spread. It followed the 2 trails the bone tar made as it ran towards the drains. The flames shot up with startling ferocity, sending up 2 curtains of fire, effectively cutting off the far corner of the shop. The flames were already as tall as me and growing. Fela had worked her way out from behind the workbench and hurried along the wall towards one of the floor drains. Since the bone tar was pouring down the grate, there was a gap close to the wall, clear of flame or fog. Fela was just about to sprint past when dark fog began to boil up out of the grate. She gave a short, startled shriek as she backed away. The fog was burning even as it boiled up, engulfing everything in a roiling pool of flame. I finally made my way past the last table. Without slowing, I held my breath, closed my eyes, and jumped over the fog, not wanting to let the horrible corrosive stuff touch my legs. I felt a brief, intense flash of heat on my hands and face, but my wet clothing kept me from being burned or catching fire. Since my eyes were closed, I landed awkwardly, banging my hip against the stone top of a work table. I ignored it and ran to Fela. She had been backing away from the fire towards the outer wall of the shop, but now she was staring at me, hands half raised protectively. "Put your arms down!" I shouted as I ran up to her, spreading my dripping wet cloak with both hands. I don't know if she heard me over the roar of the flames, but regardless, Fela understood. She lowered her hands and stepped towards the cloak. As I closed the final distance between us, I glanced behind and saw the fire was growing even faster than I'd expected. The fog clung to the floor, over a foot deep, black as pitch. The flames were so high I couldn't see to the other side, let alone guess how thick the wall of fire had become. Just before Fela stepped into the cloak, I lifted it to completely engulf her head. "I'm going to have to carry you out," I shouted as I bundled the cloak around her. "Your legs will burn if you try to wade through." She said something in reply, but it was muffled by the layers of wet cloth, and I couldn't make it out over the roar of the fire. I picked her up, not in front of me like Prince Gallant out of some storybook, but over one shoulder, the way you carry a sack of potatoes. Her hip pressed hard into my shoulder, and I pelted towards the fire. The heat battered the front of my body, and I threw my free arm up to protect my face, praying the moisture on my trousers would save my legs from the worst of the corrosive nature of the fog. I drew a deep breath just before I hit the fire, but the air was sharp and acrid. I coughed reflexively and sucked down another lungful of the burning air just as I entered the wall of flame. I felt the sharp chill of the fog around my lower legs, and there was fire all around me as I ran, coughing and drawing in more bad air. I grew dizzy and tasted ammonia. Some distant, rational part of my mind thought, of course, to make it volatile. Then nothing. When I awoke, the first thing that sprang to my mind was not what you might expect. Then again, it might not be that much of a surprise if you have ever been young yourself.
What time is it?
I asked frantically.
First bell afternoon, a female voice said. Don't try to get up.
I slumped back against the bed. I was supposed to have met with Denner at the Aeolian an hour ago. Miserable and with a sour knot in my stomach, I took in my surroundings. The distinctive antiseptic tang in the air let me know I was somewhere in the Medica. The bed was a giveaway, too. Comfortable enough to sleep in, but not so comfortable that you'd want to lie around. I turned my head and saw a familiar pair of striking green eyes, framed by close-cropped blonde hair.
Oh.
I relaxed back onto the pillow.
Hello, Mola.
Mola stood next to one of the tall counters that lined the edges of the room. The classic dark colors of those who worked at the Medica made her pale complexion seem even more so.
Hello, Quoth,
she said, continuing to write her treatment report.
I heard you finally got promoted to Elther, I said. Congratulations. Everyone knows you deserved it a long time ago.
She looked up, her pale lips curving into a small smile.
The heat doesn't seem to have damaged the gilding on your tongue, she lay down her pen. How does the rest of you feel?
My legs feel fine, but numb, so I'm guessing I got burned, but you've already done something about it. I lifted up the bedsheet, looked under it, then tucked it carefully back into place.
I also seem to be in an advanced state of undress.
I felt a momentary panic.
Is Fela all right?
Mola nodded seriously and moved closer to stand by the side of the bed.
She has a bruise or two from when you dropped her, and is a little singed around the ankles, but she came out of it better than you did. How is everyone else from the fishery? Surprisingly good, all things considered. A few burns from heat or acid, one case of metal poisoning, but it was minor. Smoke tends to be the real troublemaker with fires, but whatever was burning over there didn't seem to give off any smoke.
It did give off a sort of ammonia fume. I took a few deep experimental breaths.
But my lungs don't seem to be burned, I said, relieved. I only got about 3 breaths of it before I passed out.
There was a knock on the door, and Sim's head popped in.
You're not naked, are you?
Mostly, I said, but the dangerous parts are covered up. Willem followed in, looking distinctly uncomfortable.
You're not nearly as pink as you were before, he said. I'm guessing that's a good sign.
His legs are going to hurt for a while, but there's no permanent damage, she said.
I brought fresh clothes, Sim said cheerily. The ones you were wearing were ruined.
I hope you chose something suitable from my vast wardrobe, I said dryly to hide my embarrassment. Sim shrugged off my comment.
You showed up without shoes, but I couldn't find another pair in your room.
I don't have a second pair, I said as I took the bundle of clothes from Sim. It's fine, I've been barefoot before. I walked away from my little adventure without any permanent damage. However, right now there wasn't a part of me that didn't hurt. I had flash burn across the backs of my hands and neck and mild acid burns across my lower legs from where I'd waded through the fire fog. Despite all this, I made my limping way the long 3 miles across the river to Imre, hoping against hope that I might still find Denna waiting. Diok eyed me speculatively as I crossed the courtyard toward the Aeolian. He looked me up and down pointedly.
Little boy, you look like you fell off a horse. Where are your shoes?
A good morning to you too, I said sarcastically.
A good afternoon,
he corrected, with a significant glance up at the sun. I began to brush past him, but he held up a hand to stop me.
She's gone, I'm afraid.
Black sodding damn. I slumped, too weary to curse my luck properly. Diok gave me a sympathetic grimace.
She asked about you, he said consolingly, and waited for a good long while, too, almost an hour. Longest I've ever seen that one sit still.
Did she leave with someone? Diok looked down at his hands where he was toying with a copper penny, rolling it back and forth over his knuckles.
She's not really the sort of girl who spends a lot of time alone.
He gave me a sympathetic look.
She turned a few away, but did eventually leave with a fella. I don't think she was really with him, if you catch my meaning. She's been looking for a patron, and this fellow had that sort of look about him, white-haired, wealthy, you know the type.
I sighed.
Oh, if you happen to see her, could you tell her?
I paused, trying to think of how I could describe what had happened.
Can you make unavoidably detained sound a little more poetic?
I reckon I can. I'll describe your hangdog look and shoeless state for her too. Lay you a good solid groundwork for some groveling.
I smiled despite myself.
Thanks.
Can I buy you a drink?
He asked.
It's a little early for me, but I can always make an exception for a friend.
I shook my head. I should be getting back. I've got things to do. I limped back to Anchors and found the common room buzzing with excited folk talking about the fire in the fishery. Not wanting to answer any questions, I slunk into an out-of-the-way table and got one of the serving girls to bring me a bowl of soup and some bread. As I ate, my finely tuned eavesdropper's ears picked out pieces of the stories people were telling. It was only then, hearing it from other people, that I realized what I had done. I was used to people talking about me. As I've said, I had been actively building a reputation for myself. But this was different. This was real. People were already embroidering the details and confusing parts. But the heart of the story was still there. I had saved Fela, rushed into the fire, and carried her to safety. Just like Prince Gallant, out of some storybook. It was my first taste of being a hero. I found it quite to my liking. Chapter 67 A Matter of Hands. After lunch, at Anchors, I decided to return to the fishery and see how much damage had been done. The stories I'd overheard implied that the fire had been brought under control fairly quickly. If that was the case, I might even be able to finish work on my blue emissors. If not, I might at least be able to reclaim my missing cloak. Surprisingly, the majority of the fishery made it through the fire without much damage at all, but the northeast quarter of the shop was practically destroyed. There was nothing left but a jumble of broken stone and glass and ash. Bright blurs of copper and silver spread over broken tabletops and portions of the floor where various metals had been melted by the heat of the fire. More unsettling than the wreckage was the fact that the workshop was deserted. I'd never seen the place empty before. I knocked on Kilvin's office door, then peered inside. Empty. That made a certain amount of sense. Without Kilvin, there was no one to organize the cleanup. Finishing the emitters took hours longer than I'd expected. My injuries distracted me, and my bandaged thumb made my hand slightly clumsy. As with most artificing, this job required two skilled hands. Even the minor encumbrance of a bandage was a serious inconvenience. Still, I finished the project without incident and was just preparing to test the emitters when I heard Kilvin in the hallway, cursing in Siaru. I glanced over my shoulder just in time to see him stomp through the doorway towards his office, followed by one of Master Arwill's gillers. I closed the fume hood and walked toward Kilvin's office, mindful of where I set my bare feet. Through the window, I could see Kilvin waving his arms like a farmer shoeing cows. His hands were swathed in white bandages nearly to the elbow.
"Enough," he said. "I will tend them myself."
The man caught hold of one of Kilvin's arms and made adjustments to the bandages. Kilvin pulled his hands away and held them high in the air, out of reach.
"Linsadla, enough is enough,"
the man said, something too quiet for me to hear, but Kilvin continued to shake his head.
"No, and no more of your drugs. I've slept long enough."
Kilvin motioned me inside.
"Elder Quoth, I need to speak to you."
Not knowing what to expect, I stepped into his office. Kilvin gave me a dark look.
"Do you see what I find after the fire is quenched?"
he asked, gesturing towards a mass of dark cloth on his private work table. Kilvin lifted one corner of it carefully with a bandaged hand, and I recognized it as the charred remains of my cloak. Kilvin shook it once, sharply, and my hand lamp tumbled free, rolling awkwardly across the table.
"We spoke about your thieves' lamp not more than 2 days ago, yet today I find it lying about where anyone of questionable character might take it for their own."
He scowled at me.
"What do you have to say for yourself?"
I gaped.
"I'm sorry, Master Kilvin. They took me away."
He glanced at my feet, still scowling.
"And why are you unshod? Even an Elir should have better sense than to wander naked-footed in a place such as this. Your behavior lately has been quite reckless. I am dismayed."
As I fumbled about for an explanation, Kilvin's grim expression spread into a sudden smile.
"I'm joking with you, of course,"
he said gently.
"I owe you a great weight of thanks for pulling Raelar Fela from the fire today."
He reached out to pat me on the shoulder, then thought better of it when he remembered the bandages on his hand. I felt my body go limp with relief. I picked up the lamp and turned it over in my hand. It didn't seem to have been damaged by the fire or corroded by the bone tar. Kilvin brought out a small sack and laid it on the table as well.
"These things were also in your cloak," he said. "Many things. Your pockets were full as a tinker's pack."
"You seem in a good mood, Master Kilvin,"
I said cautiously, wondering what painkiller he'd been given at the Medica.
"I am,"
he said cheerfully.
"Do you know the saying, Chan Vien Edan Kut?"
I tried to puzzle it out. 7 years, I don't know, coat."
"Expect disaster every 7 years," he said. "It is an old saying, and true enough, this has been 2 years overdue."
He gestured to the wreckage of his shop with a bandaged hand.
And now that it has come, it proves a mild disaster. My lamps were undamaged. No one was killed. Of all the small injuries, mine were the worst, as it should be.
I eyed his bandages, my stomach clenching at the thought of something happening to his skilled artificer's hands.
How are you?
I asked carefully.
Second-grade burns, he said,
then waved away my concerned exclamation before it hardly began.
Just blisters. Painful, but no charring. No long-term loss of mobility.
He gave an exasperated sigh.
Still, I will have a damn time getting any work done for the next 3 span.
If all you need is hands, I could lend them, Master Kilvin.
He gave a respectful nod.
That is a generous offer, Elier. If it were merely a matter of hands, I would accept, but much of my work involves sigildry that would be...
He paused, choosing his next word carefully.
Unwise for an Elier to have contact with.
Then you should promote me to Raylar, Master Kilvin, I said with a smile, so I might better serve you.
He gave a deep chuckle.
I may at that, if you continue your good works.
I decided to change the subject rather than push my luck.
What went wrong with the canister?
Too cold,
Kilvin said.
The metal was just a shell protecting a glass container inside and keeping the temperature low. I suspect that the canister sigildry was damaged, so it grew colder and colder when the reagent froze.
I nodded, finally understanding.
It cracked the inner glass container like a bottle of beer when it freezes, then ate through the metal of the canister.
Kilvin nodded.
Jaxim is currently under the weight of my displeasure,
he said darkly.
He told me you brought it to his attention.
I was sure the whole building would burn to the ground, I said. I can't imagine how you managed to get it under control so easily.
Easily?
He asked, sounding vaguely amused.
Quickly, yes, but I did not know it was easily.
How did you manage it? He smiled at me.
Good question. How do you think?
Well, I heard one student say that you strode out of your office and called the fire's name, just like Tarball in the Great. You said, "Fire, be still," and the fire obeyed.
Kilvin gave a great laugh.
I like that story,
he said, grinning widely behind his beard.
But I have a question for you. How did you make it through the fire? The reagent produces a most intense flame. How is it you are not burned?
I used a drench to wet myself, Master Kilvin.
Kilvin looked thoughtful.
Jaxim saw you leaping through the fire just moments after the reagent spilled. The drench is quick, but not so quick as that.
I'm afraid I broke it, Master Kilvin. It seemed the only way.
Kilvin squinted through the window of his office, frowned, then left and walked to the other end of the shop toward the shattered drench. Kneeling down, he picked up a jagged piece of glass between his bandaged fingers.
How in all the 4 corners did you manage to break my drench, Elier Quoth?
His tone was so puzzled that I actually laughed.
Well, Master Kilvin, according to the students, I staved it in with a single blow from my mighty hand.
Kilvin grinned again.
I like that story too, but I do not believe it.
More reputable sources claim I used a piece of bar iron from a nearby table.
Kilvin shook his head.
You were a fine boy, but this twice-tough glass was made by my own hands. Broad-shouldered Kamar could not break it with an anvil hammer.
He dropped the piece of glass and came back to his feet.
Let the others tell whatever stories they wish, but between us, let us share secrets.
It's no great mystery, I admitted. I know the sigildry for twice-tough glass. What I can make, I can break.
But where was your source?
Kilvin said. You could have nothing ready on such short notice.
I held up my bandaged thumb.
Blood, he said, sounding surprised. Using the heat of your blood could be called reckless, Elliar Quoth. What of binder's chills? What if you had gone into hypothermic shock?
My options were rather limited, Master Kilvin, I said. Kilvin nodded thoughtfully.
Quite impressive. To unbind what I have wrought with nothing more than blood.
He started to run a hand through his beard, then frowned in irritation when the bandages made this impossible. What of you, Master Kilvin? How did you manage to get the fire under control?
Not using the name of fire, he conceded. If Elodin had been here, matters would have been much simpler, but as the name of fire is unknown to me, I was left to my own devices.
I gave him a cautious look, not sure whether he was making another joke or not. Kilvin's deadpan humor was hard to detect at times.
Elodin knows the name of fire.
Kilvin nodded.
There may be one or two others here at the university, but Elodin has the surest grip of it.
The name of fire, I said slowly. And they could have called it, and the fire would have done what they said, like Tabal in the Great.
Kilvin nodded again.
But those are just stories, I protested.
He gave me an amused look.
Where do you think stories come from, Elliar Quoth? Every tale has deep roots somewhere in the world.
What sort of a name is it? How does it work?
Kilvin hesitated for a moment, then shrugged his massive shoulders.
It is troublesome to explain in this language. In any language. Ask Elodin, he makes a habit of studying such things.
I knew firsthand how helpful Elodin would be.
So how did you stop the fire?
There is little mystery in it, he said. I was prepared for such an accident and had a small vial of the reagent in my office. I used it as a link and drew heat from the spill. The reagent grew too cold to boil and the remaining fog burned away. The lion's share of the reagent drained down the grates while Jackson and the others scattered lime and sand to control what was left.
You can't be serious, I said. It was a furnace in here. You couldn't have moved that many thorms of heat. Where would you have put it?
I had an empty heat eater, ready for just such an emergency. Fire is the simplest of troubles I have prepared for.
I waved his explanation aside.
Even so, there's no way. It must have been...
I tried to calculate how much heat he would have had to move, but stalled out, not knowing where to begin.
I estimate 850 million thorms, Kilvin said. Though we must check the trap for a more accurate number.
I was speechless.
But how?
Quickly.
He made a significant gesture with his bandaged hands.
But not easily.
Chapter 68 The Ever-Changing Wind.
I trudged through the next day barefoot, cloakless, and thinking grim thoughts about my life. The novelty of playing hero faded quickly in light of my situation. I had one ragged suit of clothes. My flash burns were minor but incessantly painful. I had no money to buy painkillers or new clothes. I chewed bitter willow bark, and bitter was my mood. My poverty hung around my neck like a heavy stone. Never before had I been more aware of the difference between myself and the other students. Everyone attending the university had a safety net to fall back on. Sim's parents were a Turan nobility. Will came from a wealthy merchant family in the Shald. If things got rough for them, they could borrow against their family's credit or write a letter home. I, on the other hand, couldn't afford shoes. I only owned one shirt. How could I hope to stay in the university for the years it would take me to become a full arcanist? How could I hope to advance in the ranks without access to the archives? By noon, I had worked myself into such a grim mood that I snapped at Sim during lunch, and we bickered like an old married couple.
Willem offered no opinion, keeping his eyes carefully on his food. Finally, in a blatant attempt to dispel my foul mood, they invited me to go and see Three Pennies for Wishing across the river tomorrow evening. I agreed to go, as I'd heard the players were doing Feltami's original and not one of the expurgated versions. It was well suited to my mood, full of dark humour, tragedy and betrayal. After lunch, I found Kilvin had already sold half my emitters. Since they were going to be the last blue emitters made for some time, the price was high, and my share was slightly over a talent and a half. I expected Kilvin might have padded the price a little, which rankled my pride a bit, but I was in no position to look a gift horse in the mouth. But even this did nothing to improve my mood. Now I could afford shoes and a second-hand cloak. If I worked like a dog for the remainder of the term, I might be able to earn enough to eke out my interest devi and tuition as well. The thought brought me no joy. More than ever, I was aware how tenuous my situation was. I was a hair's breadth away from disaster. My mood spiraled downward, and I skipped advanced sympathy in favour of going over the river to Imre. The thought of seeing Denner was the only thing that had the potential to raise my spirits a little. I still needed to explain to her why I'd missed our lunch date. On my way to the Aeolian, I bought a pair of low boots, good for walking and warm enough for the winter months ahead. It nearly emptied my purse again. I sullenly counted my money as I left the cobbler's shop, 3 jots and a drab. I'd had more money living on the streets of Tarbin.
"Your timing's good today," Diok said as I approached the Aeolian. "We've got someone waiting for you."
I felt a foolish grin spread to my face and clapped him on the shoulder as I headed inside. Instead of Denner, I spotted Fela sitting at a table by herself. Stanchion stood nearby chatting with her. When he saw me approaching, he waved me over and wandered back to his usual perch at the bar, clapping me affectionately on the shoulder as he walked by. When she saw me, Fela came to her feet and rushed toward me. For a second, I thought she was going to run into my arms as if we were reunited lovers in some overacted Aturan tragedy. But she pulled up short of that, her dark hair swinging. She was lovely as always, but with a heavy, purpling bruise darkening one of her high cheekbones.
"Oh, no," I said, my hand going to my face in sympathetic pain. "Is that from when I dropped you? I'm so sorry."
She gave me an incredulous look, then burst out laughing.
"You're apologizing for pulling me out of a fiery hell."
"Just the part where I passed out and dropped you. It was sheer stupidity. I forgot to hold my breath and sucked down some bad air. Were you hurt anywhere else?"
"Nowhere I can show you in public,"
she said with a slight grimace, shifting her hips in a way I found most distracting. "Nothing too bad, I hope." She put on a fierce expression.
"Yes, well, I expect you to do a better job next time. A girl gets her life saved, she expects gentler treatment all around."
"Fair enough," I said, relaxing. "We'll treat this as a practice run." There was a heartbeat of silence between us, and Fela's smile faded a bit. She reached out halfway to me with one hand, then hesitated, and let it fall back to her side.
"Seriously, Quoth, that was the worst moment of my whole life. There was fire everywhere."
She looked down, blinking.
"I knew I was going to die. I really knew it. But I just stood there like some scared rabbit."
She looked up, blinking away tears, and her smile burst out again, dazzling as ever.
"Then you were there, running through the fire. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It was like... Have you ever seen Deonica?"
I nodded and smiled.
"It was like watching Tarsus bursting out of hell. You came through the fire and I knew everything was going to be all right."
She took a half step toward me and rested a hand on my arm. I could feel the warmth of it through my shirt.
"I was going to die there,"
she broke off, embarrassed.
"I'm just repeating myself now."
I shook my head.
"That's not true. I saw you. You were looking for a way out." "No. I was just standing there like one of those silly girls in those stories my mother used to read me. I always hated them. I used to ask, why doesn't she push the witch out of the window? Why doesn't she poison the ogre's food?"
Fela was looking down at her feet now, her hair falling to hide her face. Her voice grew softer and softer, until it was barely louder than a sigh.
Can't she just sit there waiting to be saved? Why doesn't she save herself?
I lay my hand on top of hers in what I hoped was a comforting way. When I did, I noticed something. Her hand wasn't the delicate, fragile thing I had expected. It was strong and calloused, a sculptor's hand that knew hard hours of work with hammer and chisel. "This isn't a maiden's hand," I said. She looked up at me, her eyes luminous with the beginning of tears. She gave a startled laugh that was half sob.
What?
I flushed with embarrassment as I realized what I'd said, but pushed ahead. "This isn't the hand of some swooning princess who sits tatting lace and waiting for some prince to save her. This is the hand of a woman who would climb a rope of her own hair to freedom, or kill a captor ogre in his sleep." I looked into her eyes. "And this is the hand of a woman who would have made it through the fire on her own if I hadn't been there. Singed, perhaps, but safe." I brought her hand to my lips and kissed it. It seemed like the thing to do. "All the same, I am glad I was there to help," I smiled. "So, like Tarsus?" Her smile dazzled me again.
"Like Tarsus, Prince Gallant, and Orin Velsitor all rolled into one?"
she said, laughing. She gripped my hand.
"Come see. I have something for you."
Phalo pulled me back to the table where she'd been sitting and handed me a bundle of cloth.
"I asked Will and Sim what I could get you as a gift, and it seemed somehow appropriate."
She paused, suddenly shy. It was a cloak. It was a deep forest green, rich cloth, fine cut. It hadn't been bought off the back of some fripperer's cart either. This was the sort of clothing I could never hope to afford for myself.
"I had the tailor sew a bunch of little pockets into it," she said nervously. "Will and Sim both mentioned how that was important."
"It's lovely," I said. Her smile beamed out again.
"I had to guess at the measurements," she admitted. "Let's see if it fits."
She took the cloak out of my hands and stepped close to me, spreading it over my shoulders, her arms circling me in something very near to an embrace. I stood there, to use Phaela's words, like a scared rabbit. She was close enough that I could feel the warmth of her, and when she leaned to adjust the way the cloak lay across my shoulders, one of her breasts brushed my arm. I stood still as a statue. Over Phaela's shoulder I saw Diok grin from where he leaned in the doorway across the room. Phaela stepped back, eyed me critically, then stepped close again, and made a small adjustment to the way the cloak fastened across my chest.
"It suits you,"
she said.
"The collar brings out your eyes. Not that they need it. They're the greenest thing I've seen today, like a piece of spring."
As Phaela stepped back to admire her handiwork, I saw a familiar shape leaving the Aeolian through the front door. Denna. I only caught a brief glimpse of her profile, but I recognized her as surely as I know the backs of my own hands. What she had seen and what conclusions she had drawn from it, I could only guess. My first impulse was to bolt out of the door after her, to explain why I had broken our date 2 days ago, to say I was sorry, to make it clear that the woman with her arms around me had just been giving me a gift, nothing more. Phaela smoothed the cloak over my shoulder and looked at me with eyes that only moments before had been luminous with the beginnings of tears. "It fits perfectly," I said, taking the cloth between my fingers and fanning it out to the side. "It's much better than I deserve, and you shouldn't have. But I thank you."
"I wanted to show you how much I appreciated what you did."
She reached out to touch my arm again.
"This is nothing, really. If there's anything I can ever do for you, any favor, you should stop by."
She paused, looking at me quizzically.
"Are you all right?"
I glanced past her towards the doorway. Denna could be anywhere by now. I'd never be able to catch her. "I'm fine," I lied. Fela bought me a drink and we chatted for a while about small things. I was surprised to learn that she'd been working with Elodin for the last several months. She did some sculpting for him, and in exchange he occasionally tried to teach her. She rolled her eyes. He woke her in the middle of the night and took her to an abandoned quarry north of town. He put wet clay in her shoes and made her spend the entire day walking around in them. She flushed and shook her head, breaking off the story. Curious but not wanting to make her uncomfortable, I didn't pursue it any further, and we agreed between the two of us that he was more than half mad. All the while I sat facing the door, vainly hoping that Denna might return, and I could explain the truth of matters to her. Eventually, Fela headed back to the university for abstract maths. I stayed at the Aeolian, nursing a drink and trying to think how I could make things right between Denna and myself. I would have liked to have a good maudlin drink, but I couldn't afford it. So I made my slow, limping way back across the river as the sun was setting. It wasn't until I was getting ready to make one of my regular trips to the roof of Mainz that I realized the significance of something Kilvin had said to me. If the majority of the bone tar had gone down the grates. Auri. She lived in the tunnels underneath the university. I bolted to the Medica, moving as quickly as I could, despite my weary, footsore state. Halfway there, I had a stroke of luck and spotted Mola crossing the courtyard. I shouted and waved to get her attention. Mola eyed me suspiciously as I approached.
You're not going to serenade me, are you?
I shifted my lute self-consciously and shook my head.
I need a favor, I said. I have a friend that might be hurt.
She gave a weary sigh.
You should... I can't go to the Medica for help.
I let my anxiety creep into my voice.
Please, Mola. I promise it won't take more than a half hour or so, but we have to go now. I'm worried I might be too late already.
Something in my tone convinced her.
What's the matter with your friend? Maybe burns, maybe acid, maybe smoke, like the people who were caught in the fishery fire yesterday, maybe worse.
Mola started walking.
I'll get my kit from my room. I'll wait here if you don't mind.
I took a seat on a nearby bench.
I'll just slow you down.
I sat and tried to ignore my various burns and bruises, and when Mola returned, I led her to the southwestern side of Mainz, where there were a trio of decorative chimneys.
We can use these to get on the roof.
She gave me a curious look, but seemed content to hold on to her questions for now. I made my slow way up the chimney, using the protruding pieces of fieldstone as hand and footholds. This was one of the easiest ways onto the roof of Mainz. I'd chosen it partly because I wasn't sure of Mola's climbing ability and partly because my own injuries had left me feeling less than athletic. Mola joined me on the roof. She still wore her dark uniform from the Medica but had added a grey cloak from her room. I took a roundabout path so we could stay on the safer sections of Mainz. It was a cloudless night, and there was a sliver of moon to light our way.
If I didn't know you better, Mola said as we made our way around a tall brick chimney, I'd think you were luring me somewhere quiet for a sinister purpose. What makes you think I'm not?
I asked lightly.
You don't seem like the type, she said. Besides, you can barely walk. If you tried anything, I'd just push you off the roof.
Don't spare my feelings, I said with a chuckle. Even if I weren't half crippled, you could still throw me off this roof. I stumbled a little on an unseen ridge and nearly fell because my battered body was slow to respond. I sat on a piece of roof slightly higher than the rest and waited for the momentary dizziness to pass.
Are you all right?
Mola asked.
Probably not.
I pushed myself to my feet.
It's just over this next roof, I said. It might be best if you stood back a ways and stayed quiet, just in case.
I made my way to the edge of the roof. I looked down at the hedges and the apple tree. The windows were dark.
Auri!
I called softly.
Are you there?
I waited, growing more nervous by the second.
Auri! Are you hurt?
Nothing. I began to curse under my breath. Mola crossed her arms.
Right, I think I've been plenty patient here. Care to tell me what's going on?
Follow me and I'll explain.
I headed for the apple tree and began to climb carefully down. I walked around the hedge to the iron grate. The ammonia smell of bone tar wafted up from the grate, faint but persistent. I tugged on the grate and it lifted a few inches before catching on something. I made a friend a few months ago, I said, nervously sliding my hand between the bars. She lives down here. I'm worried that she might be hurt. A lot of the reagent went down the drains from the fishery. Mola was silent for a while.
You're serious?
I felt around in the dark under the grate, trying to figure out how Ayuri kept it closed.
What sort of person would live down there?
A frightened person, I said. A person who's afraid of loud noises, and people, and the open sky. It took me nearly a month to coax her out of the tunnels, let alone get close enough to talk. Mola sighed.
If you don't mind, I'll have a seat.
She walked over to the bench.
I've been on my feet all day.
I continued to feel around under the grate, but try as I might, I couldn't find a clasp anywhere. Growing increasingly frustrated, I grabbed the grate and tugged on it hard again and again. It made several echoing metallic thumps, but didn't come free.
Close?
I looked up to the edge of the roof and saw Ayuri standing there, a silhouette against the night sky, her fine hair made a cloud around her head.
Ayuri!
The tension poured out of me, leaving me feeling weak and rubbery.
Where have you been?
There were clouds,
she said simply as she walked around the edge of the roof toward the apple tree.
So I went looking for you on top of things, but the moon's coming out, so I came back.
Ayuri scampered down the tree, then pulled up short when she saw Mola's cloaked form sitting on the bench.
I brought a friend to visit, Ayuri, I said in my gentlest tones. I hope you don't mind.
There was a long pause.
Is he nice?
It's a she. And yes, she's nice.
Ayuri relaxed a bit and came a few steps closer to me.
I brought you a feather with the spring wind in it, but since you were late...
She looked at me gravely.
You get a coin instead.
She held it out at arm's length, pinched between her thumb and forefinger.
It will keep you safe at night, as much as anything can, that is.
It was shaped like an Aturan penance piece, but it gleamed silver in the moonlight. I had never seen a coin like it. Kneeling, I opened my loot case and brought out a small bundle.
I've got some tomatoes, beans, and something special.
I held out a small sack I'd spent most of my money on 2 days ago before all my troubles had started.
Sea salt.
Ayuri took it and peered inside the small leather sack.
Why, this is lovely, Quoth. What lives in the salt?
Trace minerals, I thought. Chromium, basil, malium, iodine. Everything your body needs but probably can't get from apples and bread and whatever you manage to scrounge up when I can't find you.
The dreams of fish, I said, and sailors' songs.
Ayuri nodded, satisfied, and sat down, spreading out the small cloth and arranging her food with the same care as always. I watched her as she began to eat, dipping a green bean into the salt before taking a bite. She didn't seem hurt, but it was hard to tell by the pale moonlight. I needed to be sure. Are you okay? Ayuri. She cocked her head at me, curious.
There was a big fire. A lot of it went down the grates. Did you see it?
Holy God, yes,
she said, her eyes wide.
It was all over, and all the shrews and raccoons were running every way, trying to get out.
Did any of it get on you? I asked. Did you get burned?
She shook her head, grinning a child's sly smile.
Oh no, it couldn't catch me.
Were you close to the fire? I asked. Did you breathe any of the smoke?
Why would I breathe smoke?
Ayuri looked at me as if I were simple.
The whole under thing smells like cat piss now.
She wrinkled her nose.
Except by downing and in the billows.
I relaxed a bit, but I saw Mola begin to fidget where she was sitting on the bench.
Ayuri, can my friend come over?
Auri froze with a bean halfway to her mouth, then relaxed and bobbed her head once, sending her fine hair swirling around her. I beckoned to Mola, who began to walk slowly towards us. I was a little uneasy at how their meeting would go. It had taken me over a month of gentle coaxing to draw Auri out from the tunnels underneath the university where she lived. I worried that a bad reaction from Mola might startle her back underground, where I would have no chance of finding her. I gestured to where Mola stood. "This is my friend Mola."
"Hello, Mola."
Auri looked up and smiled.
"You have sunny hair like me. Would you like an apple?"
Mola's expression was carefully blank.
"Thank you, Auri, I'd like that."
Auri jumped up and ran back to where the apple tree overhung the edge of the roof, then ran back towards us, her hair flying behind her like a flag. She handed Mola an apple.
"This one has a wish inside it,"
she said matter-of-factly.
"Make sure you know what you want before you take a bite."
That said, she settled back down and ate another bean, chewing primly. Mola looked over the apple for a long moment before taking a bite. Auri finished her meal quickly after that and tied up the bag of salt.
"Now play,"
she said, excited.
"Play."
Smiling, I brought out my lute and brushed my hands over the strings. Thankfully, my injured thumb was on my cording hand, where it would be a relatively minor inconvenience. I looked at Mola as I tuned the strings.
"You can go if you like," I told her. "I wouldn't want to accidentally serenade you."
"Oh, you mustn't go."
Auri turned to Mola, her expression deathly serious.
"His voice is like a thunderstorm, and his hands know every secret hidden deep beneath the cool, dark earth."
Mola's mouth quirked into a smile.
"I suppose I could stay for that."
So I played for both of them, while overhead the stars continued in their measured turning.
"Why haven't you told anyone?" Mola asked me as we made our way across the rooftops.
"It didn't seem like anyone's business," I said. "If she wanted people to know she was there, I imagine she'd tell them herself."
"You know what I mean," Mola said, irritated.
"I know what you mean," I sighed. "But what good would come of it? She's happy where she is."
"Happy?"
Mola sounded incredulous.
"She's ragged and half starved. She needs help, food and clothes."
"I bring her food," I said. "And I'll bring her clothes too, as soon—"
I hesitated, not wanting to admit my abject poverty, at least not in so many words.
"As soon as I can manage it."
"Why wait, if you just told someone?"
"Right," I said sarcastically. "I'm sure Jameson would rush out here with a box of chocolates and a featherbed if he knew there was a starveling, half-cracked student living under his university. They'd crock her and you know it."
"Not necessarily."
She didn't even bother finishing, knowing what I'd said was true.
"Mola, if people come looking for her, she'll just rabbit down into the tunnels. They'll scare her away, and I'll lose what chance I have to help her."
Mola looked down at me, her arms folded across her chest.
"Fine, for now. But you'll have to bring me back here later. I'll bring her some of my clothes. They'll be too big for her, but they'll be better than what she has."
I shook my head.
"It won't work.
I brought her a second-hand dress a couple of span ago. She says wearing someone else's clothes is filthy."
Mola looked puzzled.
She didn't look Kaelish, not even a little.
Maybe she was just raised that way.
"Do you feel any better?"
"Yes," I lied.
"You're shaking."
She stretched out a hand.
"Here, lean on me."
Pulling my new cloak close around me, I took her arm and made my slow way back to Anchors.
Chapter 69. Wind or Women's Fancy. Over the next two span, my new cloak kept me warm on my occasional walks to Imre, where I was consistently unsuccessful in finding Denna. I always had some reason to cross the river, borrowing a book from Devi, meeting Threep for lunch, playing at the Aeolian. But Denna was the real reason. Kilvin sold the rest of my emitters, and my mood improved as my burns healed. I had money to spare for luxuries such as soap and a second.